From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. The Chelsea Hotel at 222 West 23rd Street between 7th and 8th Avenue in Manhattan is a landmark and has been home during its long existence to some of our great artists, musicians, poets, writers, filmmakers, and rock stars. The Chelsea provided an environment that nurtured creativity. Cheryl Tippins is my guest, and her new book is all about this famous New York landmark. It's called Inside the Dream Palace, The Life and Times of New York's Legendary Chelsea Hotel. Cheryl Tippins, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hi, it's a pleasure.
So this hotel, I've spent a few nights there. the origins of the hotel I thought were fascinating. It had an egalitarian nature right at the beginning.
Yes, it was fascinating to me to delve into the origins of the hotel, because the state of the city was rather similar then to the state it was in when I began researching, because they had the city was just experiencing a recovery from a long and terrible economic crash, during which a lot of the wealth of the city had been transferred into the hands of the upper class, the Rockefellers and Jay Gould and that class of people, who felt, according to the dictates of social Darwinism, that they were the best people to have the money and handle it, and they had it by virtue of being more intelligent. So there was a big divide, a social divide, in the city at the time. People didn't know how to move forward as a city without communication among the social classes. And the Chelsea was created to solve this problem. Really interesting to research it at the time that I did.
There's something in the design of the building that meant that you would have both lower class and upper class people, or middle class people, all living there at the same time?
Yes, because the architect was a refugee from the French Revolution of 1848. His father had been an architect for the utopian philosopher Charles Fourier, who believed that everyone had to live together, all in a social diversity, making for a more rich and productive and happy population. So he had those ideas. He was more practical than his radical father, but he did believe that there was no way forward without New Yorkers acting as a community instead of as divided camps. So he created the first building in New York where different people of different economic classes shared living quarters, and that was the Chelsea Hotel. It wasn't a hotel then. It was called the Chelsea Association Building.
So all through its career, it's had this, okay, it's funny to say the career of a hotel, but it's life. It's had this nurturing, artistic nurturing quality. And was that true, you know, even back then? Were there always artists and writers and people there?
Yes. He first of all, there were 80 apartments, and on each floor there were two very large apartments, 8 to 12 rooms large, that wrapped around each end of this very large building. And then toward the center, toward the central staircase and the elevators, he put smaller apartments. So, and then he made the halls 8 feet wide. He wanted them to be as wide as a village street. So this encouraged everyone to mix together and communicate with each other across classes. And then at the top, so in the large apartments, he assembled the club. He called them club members, the original 80 residents of the building. Some of the apartments, about a third of them, were rented out, and the rental income supported the maintenance of the building. And then the others, he chose the club members who would buy the apartments. So first he chose a core population of practical sorts of people, and they were the people who actually built the hotel, the builders, interior designers, people like that. And then he chose a number of people from Wall Street, And those people ran the, they were on the board of directors, ran the finances of the building. But he also had 15 gorgeous art studios at the top of the building, and these were rented out to American artists who couldn't sell their paintings at the time because most, almost all American collectors and New York collectors wanted to buy European paintings back then in the 1880s. So they paid $47, $64 a month in rent, which they could barely afford, and they were still trading their paintings for food and clothing. But and sometimes they didn't pay their rent for months, but at least there was a percentage of the population that was artists. And Philip Hubert, who was the architect, believed very strongly in the presence of artists and businessmen and working people all together, that you needed all of these sectors of society to communicate to progress as a society. And this was the sort of laboratory that he created so that everyone could be together and talking and exchanging ideas. And art collectors could be in the same building with the artists, and audiences could be in the same building with musicians or poets. And that way you would get a sort of friction going in a cultural fire that so far the United States had lacked.
Well, even people who've never been to the Chelsea Hotel or have never been to New York, and I suppose there are some, they know about the Chelsea Hotel. I mean, if they've listened to Bob Dylan or if they've read the National Book Award winning Patti Smith's Just Kids, because it's such a famous locale among, you know, I mean, just in the last 30 or 40 years. But I was surprised to hear how many famous people from the 19th century had called it home.
Yes, William Dean Howells, who was the best-known novelist and most successful novelist of his time in the 1800s, is forgotten by many people today. But he introduced realist literature to the United States, and he wrote the first novel of middle-class life in New York City. And when he was first moving there, gathering the material for this first novel, searching for an apartment and finding out how hideously expensive apartments were, he sublet a place in the Chelsea experienced life there and was so impressed by it that he wrote a book called The Coast of Bohemia that was about the young artists and musicians and actors, acting students who lived in the Chelsea. And their passion for creating an American art that didn't exist. So if you can actually read that novel and experience life at the Chelsea at the time. And the fascinating thing about it is when you go from generation to generation, you find that the structure of the building itself seems to make this process happen with each generation, even though in the typical New York fashion, people didn't remember what had happened in the building before. Nobody remembered the purpose, the original purpose the building was designed for. And yet, it kept happening. When by the time Bob Dylan moved in the 60s, the structure of the building itself, the population of the building itself, informed his album, the creation of his album, Blonde on Blonde. And there was no clear, you know, he couldn't have said himself why the building felt right for creating a seminal album like that. But it was in the structure of the building, in the tradition of the building, the social tradition, in the forcing together of all different types of New Yorkers, and in the presence of various types of artists, of creative people, more than specifically artists.
Staying up for days in the Chelsea Hotel writing Samurai yes. Lady. Yeah. We're talking with Cheryl Tippins, and her latest book is called Inside the Dream Palace, The Life and Times of New York's Legendary Chelsea Hotel. She's also the author of February House, the story of W.H. Auden, Carson McCullough's Jane and Paul Bowles, Benjamin Britten and Gypsy Rose Lee under one roof in Brooklyn. You specialize in books that have very long subtitles.
Yes, I know. If only I could shorten them. Believe me, I would.
This book, you know, it's a book about a single edifice, but at the same time, it's about, you know, I mean, you've woven together this marvelous story of the 20th century American culture and politics. It must have been pretty hard to do. How long have you been working on this book?
Oh, for years and years. I thought it was going to take about a year and a half, and it ended up taking about six.
So you're like Harry Smith.
Yes. Believe me, I think that may have been why he became such a major character in the book, because I identified with his film Mahogany a great deal. He took 10 years, I believe, to make that film at the Chelsea. But I found that I couldn't really tell the Chelsea story without telling the story of the society around it, because everything that happened there was a response to what was happening outside the Chelsea, and everything that happened outside the Chelsea seemed to be a reflection of the microcosm within the walls of the hotel. So there was no alternative. I realized very quickly that just telling a litany of stories, you know, and then so-and-so moved in and created so-and-so, it would be very boring, and it wasn't really the story of the hotel. The thing about the place that fascinated me was, why did it work that way? And why did it keep working that way, generation after generation? So I had to show the effects and the causes of all the activity that took place in the hotel in order to tell the story. So it just took a long time, a lot of research.
I think readers will tell, just like I could tell, who you particularly loved and who you were particularly interested in. Like, for instance, Harry Smith. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, one thing I liked about Harry Smith was that I had no idea who he was before I started researching the book. And so then I found out that he had created the Anthology of American Folk Music, which is an amazing collection of American songs that usually have their origins in English ballads and so on, and many from Appalachia or from the South, a lot of blues songs that inspired the folk music rebirth in Greenwich Village and elsewhere in the 1950s and early 1960s. And it was that album centrally. There were others as well, of course, but that one really, he made this collection of songs like a kind of quilt, a tapestry. So when you listen to them as a whole, you get such a picture of the mystery and the genuine quality of this music. And that was what inspired so many musicians, including, to a certain degree, Bob Dylan. But that wasn't all he did. He also, before that, he had been living in Berkeley, and he had been inspired by films shown at the Museum of Art, the San Francisco Museum of Art, a film series there, to start making art films. He made films that, if you watch them, if you're in the audience, they were supposed to affect you, your biorhythms in a way, affect you actually neurologically. So he would time the images with the pulse rate, with the rate of breathing, to try to jumpstart people into a sort of ecstatic state or a different state of awareness. And at first, he had to hand paint these films frame by frame because he couldn't afford a camera. So he was a very eccentric person. He came to New York, and then he made the Anthology of American Folk Music just because he needed some money. And he was an amazing collector, so he had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these records. So Mo Ash suggested that he make this anthology. And then after that, he started making films again, and he moved into the Chelsea. Some artist friends moved him into the Chelsea because they were worried that he wasn't taking very good care of himself, and this way they could keep an eye on him. And there, he started to make a film based on Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Weill's The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahogany. He started to see it as a parable of New York in the 1970s because it was about a city, a pleasure city, where you can do anything you want. Everything is allowed. But the only sin is having no money. If you have no money, if you can't pay your debts, then you probably will have a death sentence and be hanged. So he saw this as a parable of New York during the horrible state of stagflation in the 1970s, and he started making a film based on mahogany using people who were in the Chelsea Hotel, like Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe and all of his other, Allen Ginsberg, and other friends he had. And he made this film that he hoped would save America. So he just was a very eccentric and exciting and visionary person, and I just became absolutely captivated by him. Also, in the 1960s, during the political anti-war movement, people like Ed Sanders, who were Abby Hoffman, who were organizing demonstrations when they planned the levitation of the Pentagon. It was Harry Smith they came to get the spell to levitate the Pentagon, and so on. He was also the house magician and occultist. So he was a man of many talents. And I had never gotten the chance to write about someone so fascinating. So I did. I got a little obsessed with Harry Smith, I have to admit.
Yeah, with good reason. We're talking with Cheryl Tippins, and her new book is all about the Chelsea Hotel, Inside the Dream Palace. Speaking of filmmakers, I think you were also very fond of Shirley Clarke. And she had this crazy idea that someday people would send a video on their phones using satellites.
Yes, it was fascinating because Shirley Clarke was the daughter of a very rich Park Avenue family, and she'd rebelled against her family, and she had become a dancer. And she started, when she was a young married woman, she became also got interested in experimental film. But she always saw film and then later video from the point of view of a dancer. So her films were beautiful shots of sort of swirling shots initially, her first experimental films. And then when she did video, she was fascinated by the instant feedback. It's hard to imagine it now, but this was so miraculous to them that you didn't have to wait for it to be developed. You could see it instantly on a monitor in front of you, what you were shooting. And she actually put monitors all over the hotel and elsewhere in New York, and then would go around the hotel with cameras. So you might come out of an elevator in the Chelsea, and you would see on a monitor an image of the roof of the Chelsea or someone in their apartment or something like that. She kind of tried to turn the whole Chelsea into a brain that had different thoughts or different images on different floors. And that would have been interesting to a certain point, but also living at the Chelsea at times was the science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke. And Arthur C. Clarke and Shirley Clarke were very close friends. He lived on the top floor, and she lived in a pyramid on the roof of the Chelsea. And they socialized a lot. They had a lot of parties on the roof. And he was very much into communication satellites. And so together they started thinking about, what if you could do this instant feedback? What if you could send videos instantly to someone in another country? It would be such a tool for democracy, because if people were having revolutions, they could send images of it instantly to the other side of the world, and also artists could communicate with images right away. And so it's basically the internet. So that was so much fun to write about, when they were just realizing the potential of this art form, and I was using it to write about it. It was wonderful time travel for me, and very exciting to think that, you usually read about these ideas hatching at MIT, but this was the roof of the Chelsea. They would go out around the city, and they would videotape things all night long, things like Sun Ra performances and everything that was happening in New York. And then they would come back to the roof of the Chelsea, and they would project them onto monitors. They would show back all of the different things on a sort of sculptural array of monitors and see them juxtaposed against one another, and they would watch them as the sun rose. They thought of it as a sort of a ritual. And, this was long before we had the internet. So that was really fascinating to find out about.
Very, very prescient thoughts that they were having.
Yes.
We're talking with Cheryl Tippins. Her new book is called Inside the Dream Palace, The Life and Times of New York's Legendary Chelsea Hotel. One of my favorite scenes in your book is there's a reception for Jackson Pollock, the great painter of... Go ahead, you tell.
Well, I guess I'm going to start a little farther back and explain that. First, from the 1880s, there were artists living in the Chelsea from the very beginning, from its very creation. And when you have a group of artists who are good at what they do and are very passionate, eventually they attract patrons and collectors. So there was an artist, Arthur B. Davies, a symbolist painter, who had been the artist most responsible for the 1913 Armory Show in New York that introduced Americans to European modern art. It was a seminal show. And Arthur B. Davies had a secret. He had a wife supporting him in upstate New York with their family, their children. But he also had a second wife who was his former model in New York City. And the reason he had organized the Armory Show in the first place was because he needed income to support the mistress because she was pregnant. So then he had two families, one upstate and one in the city. And this became more and more difficult for him to conceal, particularly when his daughter of his second wife started attending school with his artist friends and couldn't bring her friends home because those friends' parents would know who her parents were, and it was all a secret. So finally, he decided to send his second wife and daughter off to Europe, where they would be hidden and he could visit them once a year. So when he did that, he moved into the Chelsea, and he had a beautiful top-floor corner, high-ceiling studio with windows looking out over all of the south end of Manhattan, overlooking Manhattan. And there he hung his collection of Cezannes and Seurats and Picassos and put an easel in the middle of the room and started painting his third mistress, his Reith McEntire, who had been a teenager when he first started painting her. And she was an opera singer, so she would sing opera while he painted her. So it was all very romantic. And this attracted patronesses like Abby Rockefeller and Lizzie Bliss, who had backed the Armory Show, and they just thought this was the most romantic thing. So they would come and see his paintings, and he educated them in how to look at modern art and how to choose what to buy. So he helped them assemble their modern art collections. Then he died, and all of his secrets were revealed, and so his first wife was traumatized. But meanwhile, the patronesses who adored him created the Museum of Modern Art in his memory in New York, and also to house the collections that he had helped them build, their own collections.
So that grew out of the Chelsea Hotel.
That grew out of the Chelsea Hotel. So for that reason, the Chelsea Hotel developed a reputation not only among artists, but among wealthy collectors. So in the next generation, Peggy Guggenheim was trying to jumpstart a modern art tradition in New York. She had just come back from Europe because of the beginning of World War II with all of her French artists who were a pain in the neck. And she had gotten them started, though. But she wanted to start an American, a tradition of American modern artists, abstract artists, or modern artists. And so Jackson Pollock was one of her first attempts to do this. And so she took him, she arranged a lunch to introduce him to patrons at the Chelsea Hotel, because that was the place you went to be behind the veil of the artistic process, to be in a really legitimate place. She couldn't take them to his actual cold water loft, that was too miserable, but she could take them to the Chelsea, which was, Victorian style, and still, if not grand, at least cozy. So she took them to the restaurant there, to a private dining room, and she had, with her cousin Hazel McKinley and a group of other high-flying patrons, potential patrons, with their World War II money ready to spend, and she took Jackson Pollock, and he was there. But Pollock was so stressed out by having to impress these people, who had their class anyway, if not these individuals, had been behind cutting off the WPA payments that he'd been supported by before Peggy Guggenheim came along, that he just drank through the whole lunch, and he ended up throwing up on the carpet right in front of all these patrons. And Peggy was furious. She had to hustle him away. The luncheon broke up, and all the patrons left in a hurry. But then Hazel, Peggy's sister, went over, Hazel McKinley, actually, is her last name, she went over to the manager of the restaurant, and she said, "If I were you, I'd cut out that square of carpet and save it, because it's going to be worth millions one day." So, I don't know if he did or not. I doubt it.
Since it was exactly like Pollock's paintings. In a way, yes. Speaking of valuable things that people, you know, could have collected there at the Chelsea, there was a hotel register that was signed by Gore Vidal and Jack Kerouac one night.
Yes. Yes. They knew that Dylan Thomas had liked, the Chelsea Hotel was like a second home to poet Dylan Thomas, and both Jack Kerouac and Gore Vidal felt that Dylan Thomas had awakened America to poetry following the World War II, and they wanted to honor him. And they had been out drinking all night, and they didn't know each other very well, and they decided in their state of inebriation that they were going to honor Dylan Thomas by consummating their relationship at the Chelsea Hotel. So they, with a flourish, they signed the log, according to Gore Vidal, and went upstairs and did so. not very enthusiastically, but dutifully, as he recorded. But, you know, I tried very hard to have a look at this log, and Stanley Bard, the owner at the time, claims he doesn't know where it is. So it seems to have been lost to history, unless he's saving it for later times, which is his right.
It's possible. The book is Inside the Dream Palace, The Life and Times of New York's Legendary Chelsea Hotel, and the author is Cheryl Tippins. Cheryl Tippins, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you. It was a great pleasure. Thanks.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page, won't you, at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can find us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Cheryl Tippins. Her new book, Inside the Dream Palace, The Life and Times of New York's Legendary Chelsea Hotel. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.